The following program may contain subject matter and language not suitable for all ages. If you are sensitive to true crime details or adult language, perhaps you might want to check out some of our other shows on the network, which are safe for all ages. So with viewer and listener discretion advised, let's get to the show.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Murder, Mysteries, and More. My name is Nicole Mancha, and I am here with my lovely co-host, Alex Mercado.
Bonjour.
And we're here with our other lovely co-host and wonderful producer, Mike Mercado.
Hola, everybody.
We're so diverse.
So diverse.
Loving it. We love you, friends.
This has been a great episode. Thank you so much.
Yay, love it. Well, hopefully you guys are each enjoying your day, and thank you for making us a part of your day. And on today's episode, since the Academy Awards are now behind us, I thought we should hit into a subject that might be kind of pertinent, because 1917, if you're listening to this,
the big winners,
might have actually won Best Picture. If you were on Team Alex, you're rooting for that. If you're on Team Michael, you're rooting for Parasite. Either way, 1917, a great movie. But it had me thinking, the sexy, quote-unquote sexy war, really is World War II and the Civil War. Obviously, when you have an adversary that is Adolf Hitler, and then you have the storyline of brothers versus brothers, those two wars really have taken over pop culture, media, and just the attention of history books. But one war that at least in our generation, and maybe the generation before us, and certainly the generation after us, seems almost like a different world, a different time in the world, is World War I. And on today's episode of Murder, Mysteries, and More, we dive into what is considered the Great War, one of the first modern day wars. It is World War I. Now, you two are educated, and obviously you guys are fascinated with wars.
These are facts, yes.
And American history. We'll start with you, good brother. When I say World War I, what comes up to mind?
It's almost a forgotten war. I think, like you said, it's not the sexy one. It's almost like a prequel to World War II.
That's exactly what it is, actually.
You know what I mean, though? But, like, you look at it like that as a movie person, even, or as a storyteller. You're like, you're right, Mike. It's not the sexy one. It doesn't have, you know, an Adolf Hitler involved. It doesn't have the Axis powers involved as much. It's just very much there. And I think it was so new and so it was the first that it's kind of hard to describe nowadays compared to where we are now with our modern war. So it's very interesting to see how we're even going to address it.
So I know a little bit about it. I mean, we all went over it in school, but I did remember the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. And I did remember the Ottoman Empire, which has now since crumbled. But those are the two things that always like come up when I think about it. Outside of that, I don't know as much. But I think the reason that we know about it in general so much, A, we were all kind of like, everyone was involved, but also we did start to have some media at this point. It obviously got much larger scale for World War II, but at this point, you know, we're starting to get some media. There's starting to be more communication, I think, across like the country, which was a big change.
So before we dive deep into this conversation, make sure you guys are following us all over social media. I'm on Twitter at Mike M Media. I'm also on Instagram at Mike Mercado Media. You can follow the good brother at Mercado21 Alex on Instagram Mercado2121.
Follow me if you do.
And the Loving Nicole Manchas, everything on the socials at Typing When Tipsy. And I would like to give huge shout outs to some of the sources I use for this episode, including history.com, both the UK and the United States domains, factandnight.com, History Hits, and of course, one of the best podcasts that you can listen to, especially if you're into world history, military history, Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, one of the great podcasts that we have. Check it out. Some of it is behind a paywall, but they do have certain episodes that you could check out that are free. They're like 6-hour long epic, so I highly suggest that. But why don't we dig deep into the Great War, later to be known as World War I. This is what the history books have now said as histories look back. July 28th, 1914 to November 11th, 1918. These days are always kind of skewed because who shot first, who did this, who did that. But that is kind of the
consensus
over time. Exactly.
You know what joke I always think about is the one of the Simpsons where they talk about, imagine going to the past and telling someone back then about World War I and their answer being, wait, one?
Yeah.
Like to think about that. Like you said, it's the Great War. as it's going on. But now we look back as World War One, kind of one of those sad satire things of there will be more of these world wars, which
there have
more
been.
Sad than funny. Yeah.
And
I guess.
We'll get into all that as we go through this epic tale of World War One, because it began in 1914 after the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and lasted until 1918. During the conflict, Germany, Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, and the Ottoman Empire, the Central Powers, fought against Great Britain, France, Russia, Italy, Romania, Japan, and the United States, the Allied Powers.
Oh, that's a stacked team, just but so everyone knows.
Just to think, though, like how times have changed from, let's just say, 2020 to 1918, you look at Russia and the United States, like it's not long after that that eventually these two countries would be world powers that would continue to have a long-standing rivalry, whether it's at a boiling point or it's just under the surface.
I mean, there are people in the Allied power that are no longer on good terms to this day.
That don't exist.
That's, yeah.
And the Ottoman Empire, for all you who don't know.
It's a lazy boy, duh. It's an Ottoman.
Shut up, Alex.
Known as the Ottomans as the Empire of Rome and known in at Western Europe as the Turkish Empire, or simply Turkey, was a state and caliphate that controlled much of Southeast Europe, Western Asia, and North Africa between the 14th and earliest 20th century. So a legit powerhouse for most of the world's history up until that point. So let's get into a little bit how all this unraveled. And this is why I highly suggest you really do go through some of these Netflix documentaries, the Dan Carlin's podcast, and a lot of these different sources, because this is just the tipping point of the world, how World War One began, but also the ramifications when it came to local politics. Now, do you remember the story Anastasia?
Yes.
So do you remember the main bad guy, the wizard?
Mm-hmm.
I'm blanking on his name right now. Rammstein?
No. No. Oh my gosh, what's his name?
Rasputin.
That's what it is.
So yeah. Rasputin is actually attached to the Franz Ferdinand through like 6 degrees of the separation. So good pull by you, good brother. So
I just recently listened to something about the Romanovs.
Did you
and
really?
Rasputin. Yes, like not about 2 weeks ago.
Isn't Rammstein a band?
Rammstein is a band. That's coming to Chicago. Rasputin, du hast. Rasputin apparently had a huge dick that went through the...
I'm glad that's what you got from all your research.
Jesus Christ, Michael.
So tensions had been brewing throughout Europe, especially in the troubled Balkan region of Southeast Europe, for years before World War One actually broke out. A number of alliances, including European powers, the Ottoman Empire, Russia, and other parties, had existed for years. But political instability in the Balkans, particularly Bosnia, Serbia, and Herzegovina...
Does it still exist? I don't think it
does. I don't think it still exists. Threatened to destroy these agreements. The spark that ignited World War One was struck in Bosnia, where Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austro-Hungarian Empire, was shot to death, along with his wife Sophie, by the Serbian nationalist Gavrilo Princip on June 28, 1914. Princip and other nationalists were struggling to end Austro-Hungarian rule over Bosnia and Herzegovina. The assassination of Franz Ferdinand set off a rapidly escalating chain of events. Austria-Hungary, like many countries around the world, blamed the Serbian government for the attack and hoped to use the incident as justification for settling the question of Serbian nationalism once and for all. So it's interesting that even then, you know, people always think that it's a modern thing when and it's an evil conspiracy when you governments plot and use things to their advantage to try to go to war. But it's like they've been doing it forever. They've been doing it from the Roman Empire to the First World War.
Hidden a lot less back then. Back then, it was kind of part of the job of like corrupt politician. That's part of being a politician. Now it's more, well, we know it, but we're not going to admit it, but...
There's also, like, there wasn't social media. There wasn't all of these media outlets to constantly tell you what was going on at every single moment of every single day. And now there is. So it's definitely different because at that time, I think there was a lot of faith in who was running the country. Yeah. And you kind of didn't have much of a choice because so much of the financial capital and flow would go from the kingdom to the people. Whereas now, yes, there are definite similarities, but there is still, you have the one percenters who don't necessarily need to. Back then, I think there even the one percenters had to still have this kind of loyalty and faith within their kingdom.
I mean, history has a way of doing that, making you so rigid. I mean, look at the way we look at our Pope and president right now compared to what our grandparents looked at our Pope and president back then.
Yeah.
So another big name in this entire storyline that isn't just the Archduke is Kaiser Wilhelm II.
Kaiser Soze, yes.
Because mighty Russia supported Serbia, Austria-Hungary waited to declare war until its leaders received assurance from German leader Kaiser Wilhelm II, otherwise known as
Kaiser Soze,
that Germany would support their cause. Austro-Hungarian leader feared that a Russian intervention would involve Russia's ally, France, and possibly Great Britain as well. On July 5th, Kaiser secretly pledged to support, giving Austria-Hungary a so-called carte blanche, or blank check, assurance of Germany's backing in case of war. The dual monarchy of Austria-Hungary then sent an ultimatum to Serbia with such harsh terms as to make it almost impossible to accept. And it's such an interesting way of badgering somebody. It's like, I know what the answer is going to be. My offer is almost another insult.
Yeah, exactly.
On top of it. And that's what it was that really started off World War I. So we have the death of a leader. We have a lot of nationalists and we have a lot of turmoil in the Middle East and in Europe. So it's really interesting that we're at this point, and in 2020, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So now we actually get to the big dance. Convinced that Austria-Hungary was readying for war.
Very sports of you. The big dance, the big show, World War I.
The Serbian government ordered that the Serbian army mobilize and appealed to Russia for assistance. On July 28th, Austria-Hungary declared war on Serbia, and the tenuous peace between Europe's great powers quickly collapsed. Within a week, Russia, Belgium, France, Great Britain, and Serbia had lined up against Austria-Hungary and Germany, and World War I had officially begun. Thanks to new military technologies and the horrors of trench warfare, World War I saw unprecedented levels of carnage and destruction. By the time the war was over, the Allied powers claimed victory. More than 16 million people, soldiers, and civilians alike were dead. So we're going to jump into just kind of the brutality that was World War I. And I think one of the main reasons people don't like talking about this world, about this war specifically, is because of how gruesome and down and dirty it was, from chemical warfare to trench warfare. We were still using bayonets.
Yeah.
Like, it was a hard time. This was the first time we were seeing the arsenal brought to another level. This was a devastating war for a lot of people, especially a lot of European countries.
Well, and that's kind of what I was going to say, is that this war is new. Like, you have all of these new things that you can now use, and I don't think necessarily you understand the damage it can do, but seeing the damage is completely different.
Yeah.
It's just different witnessing it. You know, you can know what an automatic weapon will do. Watching it go into play is completely different.
Yeah.
Germany lost the most men, with 2,037,000 killed and missing in total. On average, 230 soldiers perished for every hour of fighting. 979,498 British and Empire soldiers died. 80,000 British soldiers suffered shell shock, roughly 2% of all that were called up. Shell shock was an incapacitating mental illness believed to be brought on by intense sustained artillery shelling. But now we know, and we prefer to call it PTSD. This was the first time in real war men were suffering from PTSD.
Well, that we know of, because with the Civil War and everything like that, I mean, I'm sure it happened, but we have like an actual recorded moment of it, because I'm sure the medical technology, if the artillery technology has gotten so much further, the medical technology must have gotten further as well to know, like, hey, there's something not quite right when they're coming back.
Over 57% of all combatants became casualties during World War One. It cost the Allies $36,485 to kill an opposing serviceman, more than it cost the Central Powers $11,000. 11% of France's entire population was killed or wounded during the war.
The money that you said was spent, is that in their money? I just wasn't sure if it was in today's money or if it was in back in 1918 money.
I believe it's 1918 money.
Wow, that's a lot of money.
Yeah. The war led to several innovations in manufacturing, chemistry, communications, and military tactics. World War One was the first time that aircrafts were used in war, and it meant that soldiers and civilians could be attacked from above. Advances in medicine also meant that for the first time, British deaths in battle outnumbered death by disease. So remember what we used to talk about in Civil War is a lot of people died more from the medical procedures in the tent than they did from actual war. In this case, a lot of people in British Army throughout time died from the plague and other weird diseases that were from animals and from the cold and by diseases. This was the first time that, no, other men, other militaries were killing more people than they were. They weren't there long enough to get diseases.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the fascinating thing with any sort of modern technology getting advanced is there's a positive and negative to it. So when technology gets advanced, yes, that does mean weapons are going to get advanced and things of destruction will all get advanced, but it also means medicine will also get advanced. So it's one of those, you know, the smarter we get, is it really better for us or not? I think that's the long lasting debate of how much knowledge is too much, how much technology is too much. And then you look at the positives, you look at the negatives, and you kind of have to make your educated decision of, I'd rather have this because then at least one day a cure for cancer will come. Or, well, because of this, we have this brand new bomb that sucks the air out of an entire city or something.
But it's like interesting because you talk about that and we talk about the advances in, like, obviously chemical warfare at the time and all of that. And then the money that is spent to essentially take someone else's life. And just even looking it up, like $36,000 in 1918 had the buying power of $600,000 now.
That's crazy.
So it's like $36,000 sounds like a lot of money. But then to also be like, hey, don't forget you could get a loaf of bread for like 2 pennies. Like, that has $600,000 worth of buying power.
Yeah.
And so all of that money, all of that advancement in technology and medicine is going to something that's taking the lives of others. And that's where it's, like, really wild to me.
And mind you, that's not the United States necessarily being part of it, because the United States took a little bit to get into the war. So this is mostly – again, this is why World War One, I believe, is much more – impactful to European countries because there was a lot more European involvement than, let's say, World War II, which with Pearl Harbor and then obviously with the way with the Nazis and the genocide that was, you know, what Hitler did to them. I think that's why World War II is more personal. But this one was just a nasty war.
I think part of it is also that the U.S. is extremely selfish. We don't know a lot about other countries. Like, we don't learn as much about what happens. And even in the history books that we do read, a lot of things are kind of twisted in our favor that aren't necessarily, like, the story doesn't say, oh, like, you won. But they'll be like, oh, well, we didn't lose. Like, that's kind of the stories that you get from the history a lot. So I feel like, but the thing is to be, to understand the impacts of World War II, you really do need to understand World War One and how this kind of trajectory started. But we don't learn nearly as much. And I think it's because a lot of it was that we didn't get involved in it as early on.
We're so very self-absorbed. Yes. We're telling our story. This is our story, not history. We're history.
Well, it is our history. We're not, are French people talking about the Civil War?
I don't know.
But that's my point. So to naturally just assume that, yeah, American, we all know.
That's what we've heard from foreign exchange students is that our American history and our world history, it's very different compared to the world history education get in Britain. It's a lot different than the world history you're getting here in the United States and Texas.
But the statement that was said was about the ignorance, about not caring about other people's wars. I'm saying that do other countries care about wars of other countries?
More than we do, probably, yeah.
Of other countries that don't involve them, that aren't world involvement. So are people in Italy learning about wars in South America or South Africa? Are people in Canada learning about the wars in Australia?
We can't say
you learned your history.
We're talking about world history. I think we're comparing world history lesson. We're saying the United States teaches world history. France teaches world history. Canada teaches world history. Mexico teaches world history.
World history is
known as the country that our world history lessons are very self-absorbed compared to other countries learning world history is a little more open and a little more knowledge filling, not only to themselves.
But to pertain that to World War I, where our involvement directly is later on, and my belief of the emotional attachment that Americans have to World War II is much more than World War I, because we didn't have an assassination of an archduke. This wasn't we weren't having the Western Front. World War II was obviously Pearl Harbor. Obviously, the influence of the Jewish
it's
community.
Also media. It's more media. We're seeing more of the. We saw Pearl Harbor from home. We saw these concentration camps from home. And like Nicole said from minute one, the biggest difference is probably media. Yeah. And that's when it kicked into high gear. And it's easy to overlook World War I because of World War II.
So, how much of it then is arrogance? Like, we know.
I think it's a lot of arrogance.
It's an easy narrative to say the United States is Aaron. We know that. What I'm saying is, consciously, why within people, why within us, like we have family members, not us necessarily, I'm talking about our generation as family members that served in World War II that are dying out. The admiration people had for that generation was not the same. We were very young, but World War I kids were around, and they don't talk the same way that kids from World War II talk about their soldiers.
We were also going through a depression right in the middle of that.
But that's my point. So how much of it has to do with arrogance and how much it is your actual involvement and personal ties?
I don't think there's something wrong with saying arrogance when – yeah, we probably was arrogance where we're a little less concerned about the other part of the world because we are struggling at the time compared to when we're not struggling during World War II and after. It's a little easier for to say we'll come and help. We're doing just fine. Our economy's booming compared to World War I where we're struggling – very much so as a country.
Well, and to be fair, I never said ignorance. I just said that we tend to be more self-absorbed with that kind of stuff. But part of the reason we had the depression, from what my memory serves, is because of World War I. So how could it directly be affected from that? Because all of these finances are going into it. The thing with world wars and the thing with wars anywhere around the country is that the finances and what happens in other countries that determine, you know, what we get, the goods we get. We don't get everything within the U.S. That's just part of it. It's why that whole thing happened when, you know, Trump and Mexico and all of that stuff with the avocados, and people were freaking out because the majority of our avocados come from Mexico. We rely on other countries. So the reality is that these kinds of wars did affect us even prior to, because all those finances being tied up in something else means that there is a limit that they can do for others, because it's just the goods aren't there.
So technically speaking, just for correction, because I know I read the comments, this war ends in 1918. The Great Depression is, or at least kicks off in 1929. And a lot of it believes it has to do more with the stock market at that point. So I don't know necessarily if World War I had that type of impact 10 years later. Maybe it was a different time back then. But I think it's just an interesting perspective when you start thinking of how people view other people's world history. So just wanted to see what you guys thought about that. On April 22nd, 1915, during the Second Battle of Ypres, the German soldiers attacked the Allied soldiers along the Western Front by releasing 150 tons of lethal chlorine gas at Ypres in Belgium. It was the first introduction of poison gas as a weapon in the war. And immediately after the battle, France and Britain began developing their own chemical weapons and gas masks. On the Western Front, total casualties were 3 million dead and over 7 million wounded. The Allies lost 2 million and over 5 million wounded. The Central Powers lost over 1 million and over 2.5 million wounded. Interesting enough, to survive chemical attacks, Canadian soldiers would use urinated handkerchiefs as a defense and place them on their mouth. You would do whatever you have to survive that. Now, have you guys ever seen the effects of chemical warfare from World War One?
Yeah, it's horrible.
What it does to the body, what people can do to one another. But here's the thing. This is what's fascinating. World War One happens. We have chemical warfare. And we didn't think that that was a harsh enough level. We literally create the atomic bomb. So that, more than anything, is what terrifies me about humans and future development. Nothing ever stops. There's never a floor, a ceiling to something. Nuclear weapons right now are what people are so afraid of. I think it's only a matter of time until chemical warfare is, once again, germ warfare. Biological warfare, more than anything, is the new wave. I don't know about you guys, but I think World War One really is almost a look in the mirror to a lot of modern-day society when it comes to political unrest. And that always scares me. It's like, what's the next level of viciousness people are going to be working on in the name of science and nation and defense?
I think the problem is that humans are so hung up on power just in general. Like, there is this want and need to control things, and you have people who are extremely intelligent who sometimes fall under that umbrella who want to do these things and want to create these things to see if they can, and then you have this huge problem on your hands, right? Because militaries want to buy it, they want to be a part of it, they want to have this control. And I think because it is, we're past the bayonet stage where you're physically seeing the person that you're doing this to, you can now be so disconnected with the touch of a button.
Drones and just the way it all kind of, everything now looks like Call of Duty and it's all technologically best. You're totally right that these wars, they were still using bayonets. Yeah. Like, they were still killing each other.
There was still a hand-to-hand portion.
Yeah, like, so it's crazy. Modern flamethrowers were also first used in World War One by the German forces in an attack against British at Hoog in Flanders. The earliest flamethrowers dated back to the 5th century, but Germans refined the designs that were used in the war. Leave it to Germans to find a good way to burn somebody up. In August 1914, the German army orchestrated a mass execution of Belgian civilians in Liège. The inhabitants were rounded up from the nearby villages and shot. Anyone who survived the shooting were killed with bayonets. There were a few reasons for the massacres. First, their retaliation for setbacks suffered by the German army during their invasion of Belgium. Second, much of the German army believed that the locals were actually civilian snipers who were attacking them. Third, the German troops were executing a war policy known as Schrecklichkeit, meaning frightfulness, which was intended to frighten the civilians in the occupied areas to prevent rebellion. At the beginning of the war, tanks were even grouped according to their gender. The male tanks had cannons attached, while the females carried machine guns. The prototype tank was named Little Willy. So you got to have a little levity in the middle.
Well, isn't it funny that, but think like tanks back in World War I are basically what our SUVs are running on nowadays, or our bigger Hummers or Jeeps or vehicles. Like, normal recreational vehicles are pretty much the same power as a World War I tank at the time, minus the weapons, unless you're in Texas.
And here's the thing. You weren't safe in one of those tanks necessarily the same way you are safe in a quote-unquote tank today. Think about how many soldiers or guys die in tank attacks.
Well, think about these weapons back then. We see it in Schindler's List where these weapons weren't foolproof. Like, these weapons backfired quite a bit, honestly. Like, I'm sure there was a lot of trial and error with these flamethrowers and these pistols not going off every single time, or a lot of backdraft from these wet weapons or dirty weapons.
So another interesting story from these horrors of the war. A team of miners worked in a secret to dig tunnels under the trenches during the war in order to plant and detonate mines. The detonations destroyed much of the German front line and were so great, the prime minister then heard the sound in London, 140 miles away. In America, suspicion of the Germans was so high that even German shepherd dogs were killed. Aww. The name of Frankfurters, hamburgers, sauerkraut, and Dachshunds were all changed to American names. And German stopped being taught in schools. And German language books were banned. Before the war, it had been the second most widely spoken language in the United States. Again, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
Don't ever think that, you know, we live in a special time and things like that. Like, fear-mongering.
Anyone thinks we're living in a special time at the moment.
I think people believe maybe that we're like, living the most horrible time. I think if you ask most privileged people in the first world, they think the world is something that it's not. And this is a perfect example of that. Like, people are always getting discriminated, and it's horrible. And we always try to learn our lessons, but there's always, when there's people who try to have power, there's always somebody being oppressed. And that's the truth. Those were the basic horrors of World War I, if you could use the word basic. Now it's just a little bit more of trivia or facts from the Great War. Inspired by the sight of soldiers' faces ravaged by shrapnel, many of which remain covered by masks, Harold Giles established the field of plastic surgery, pioneering the first attempts of facial reconstruction, as well as blood transfusions became routine to save soldiers, with the first blood bank established on the front line in 1917. The Dr. Doolittle stories were born of Hugh Lofting's aversion to writing his children about the true horrors of the war and trench life. Instead, more creative letters were sent. Here's a little one for you spooky lovers. Strangely, the Archduke's number plate read A111118, a series that can be read as Armistice 11, November 18. Even though they weren't granted citizenship in America until 1924, nearly 13,000 Native Americans fought during the war. Over 200,000 African Americans also served, but only 11% in combat, and even this in segregated divisions.
I mean, that's one thing that's the consistent, guys. It's good old racism, no matter if it's World War I, the Civil War, the Revolutionary War, no matter what, good old racism. Hey, we hate you, but if you join us, we'll kind of treat you a little bit better than we usually do.
Here's an interesting one. This one kind of freaked me out. Many young men faked their age in order to sign up early. We've seen that a lot during wars, especially in the back-in-the-day wars, the old-school wars. But the youngest to do so was Sidney Lewis, who was only 12 years old at the time.
That kid's a hard ass.
He would survive and even have a son that told his story.
That's awesome, though. Like, think about that, though. That's like the kids that are still alive or the kids that faked their age for joining the war by like a few years.
Quote, "He kept us out of war," was the slogan Woodrow Wilson adopted when he ran for his second term in office. However, he immediately reneged on this concept when he was sworn in, declaring war on Germany only around a month later. Nuh-uh, a politician lying? No way, that doesn't happen. Not in 1917.
Well, you're telling me Democrats and Republicans lie?
No. In order to draw the U.S. into the fight, British agents planted stories in the U.S. newspapers, stirring up anger against innocent German civilians living in the United States. During the Great War, there were over 250,000 Germans living in the United States, which were forced to register at a post office and then always carry a registration card with them. Of these, over 2,000 Germans were arrested and put in internment camps. The United States has a history of that. We even saw it in World War II.
I mean, yeah. Well, look what we did to the entire Japanese culture.
Look what we're doing to Mexicans right now.
I mean, yeah.
The only Allied power in the First World War.
I mean, while you're on it, let's just be honest. Because I've been thinking about this Super Bowl. Let's just be honest in America right now. It's never been harder to be a Latin person in America. And I get it. We, you know, black people have their issues. I get it. They have their gripes.
It's kind of an understatement. But
no offense. We're talking about three Latin people in the room right now. They have it better than we do.
Oh, no.
We didn't have. Yes, they do. Yes, they do. Mm-hmm. They don't have a president that hates them openly. We were also slaves, but we just called it indentured servants. That was the only difference that we're still going through these days. I'm just saying. It's never been harder to be a Latin person in this country compared to any other race or ethnicity currently in 2020 America. It has never been harder to be a Latin person compared to anyone else.
I don't know, man. Black people during most of history and Middle Eastern people during
9/11. When was our peak of history? Well, when was our turnaround? Like, we went right from slaves, basically, of the Spanish to slaves of the Americans. To, at best, indentured servants working for pennies on a dollar for everyone. And to nowadays, we live in a time where we're feared because our president goes openly fear like making us monsters. We own Spanish countries that we're not even taking care of, like Puerto Rico. I'm just saying, like, when was the turnaround? When did it get better? Because it's gotten better for the African-American culture not as much as we'd like, but it did get better. Compared to us, where we've kind of been living under the radar and, well, it wasn't as bad. No, it is as bad. And I hate that we don't acknowledge it is as bad. We don't have any sort of heroes to look after compared to everyone else. We don't have any role models out there being shown to the world as much as the blacks or the whites. So I just don't get where this idea of it's not that bad. No, it's terrible to be a Latin person in today's modern America.
But
I think
something that you're keeping out of the rest of it is that Puerto Rico is part of the U.S. You are an automatic U.S. citizen living in Puerto Rico, but you're an automatic U.S. citizen. People who are African American who were born here can still be treated as if they are not part of this country and they are not, they don't belong here.
Didn't we not just have a complete earth-shattering earthquake and tsunami in Puerto Rico, and it's still, and we still have parts of the Commonwealth that don't have power.
We had that in Louisiana. And that's part of us.
Look at New Orleans.
I know. We had that in Louisiana. We have it in Florida.
Look at the difference the attention got for once compared to the attention the other one got.
Oh, I don't think that's
and
fair.
All that's happening now is, what's the attention we get? Is they're locking up our children.
No, and I'm not saying that you're wrong about that, but here is the
I
biggest...
I just take it very... I get where you're saying. I just think we don't talk about it enough. And we talk about Abe Lyon. We just don't talk enough about the Latin culture being, you know, victimized in this country.
I don't think we deny that the Latin culture is victimized.
Well, I know
victimized.
No one at this table does.
But what I also think the biggest problem is, and the thing that I don't understand why a lot of us do, like on all sides of it, is why does one person's plight have to be worse than the other? Why can't we just say...
That's the only thing I disagree with. Good brother Alex. I think more than anything, it's your whole conversation, your whole concept, your whole idea to me almost becomes null and void, even as passionate and as intelligent as might be, the minute you try to downplay anybody else's struggle. Because
I'll correct that. I'm not downplaying the struggle. I'm downplaying the attention the struggle gets compared to if your skin is brown in this country compared to any other color.
Then this is my personal plight to our Hispanic community. It's why I've taken a personal responsibility in it. We have to be the ones that do it. Here's the difference. The black community has had figures that have rose, that have gone in front of the camera, that have become the president of the United States. That is on us as individuals and a people. I do not care what other communities do. It is within our community to do that, to put kids through college, to put kids through the system.
You know what? That's the hardest part of our community is it's way too divided between one color skin of brown and another skin of brown. And they speak Spanish a little too fast and they speak Spanish a little too slow.
Yeah.
And we see it in our own family. And it's very sad that you're right, that we don't have representation because there's so many of us that we can't decide who's the main one or who's the voice.
Well, and there's always been a clear divide for a lot of Hispanic cultures. Like, I even remember growing up, there was a huge thing of, oh, well, are you Puerto Rican? And people would be offended if they were Mexican. They would be offended. And it's like, first of all, why are you taking offense? Like, no one, a lot of times they don't mean it on purpose, but it's like, we have a divide within all of the Latin communities to begin with. So you have all these different ethnicities and cultures because they're all very different. And it's like, well, we can't come together because we can't all be like, hey, this person is a part of the Latino community. Like, let's rise them up, even if they're Cuban and not Puerto Rican. You know what I mean? Like, that's a huge, huge issue. Like,
it's crazy to me that people are offended by J-Lo wearing a Puerto Rican flag with an American flag. And you question that, being like, that's not two country flags. That's like if I put a Chicago flag with an American flag. No one, if I put a Texas flag with an American flag, people are going to think that's the most patriotic thing. And you're talking about the same thing is going on. A Puerto Rican flag might as well be a state flag at this point. Like, it's closer to a state than a country.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what riled me up, is the fact that people are just so ignorant to our culture.
Ignorance in general, those people that are acting that ignorant about it aren't typically other minorities. Yeah. So I don't want us to ever sound like we're attacking another minority, because by saying that my plight is more important than yours is saying that their plight isn't important. And here's the reality, right? Is that Mike and I, not as much you, but Mike and I, for the most part, we coast. We can coast if we need to. We are light enough skinned that sometimes people don't question it.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen for most people, the majority of people in the African American community.
True.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So while you have people who are light enough skin to get by, that typically does not happen just because of certain facial features or hair or whatever it may be. So I don't want to ever put one plight over the other, because I think it's a dangerous thing. And that part of what's going on in our community and the political climate is we're all so busy tearing each other apart. We don't see that if we work together, we would actually be doing so much more.
Yeah. I feel like we just never get enough defense. We never get enough backing from anyone.
All right, here's a sex one for you, Nicole, to get things back on track.
Let's get back to a little light.
The only Allied power in the First World War that did not provide its soldiers with condoms was the United States.
Shocker.
The Comstock laws that were being enforced did not allow any birth control devices nor information to be shipped abroad. As a result, over 400,000 U.S. soldiers were infected by STDs. Now, for any of you who don't know, because it's a very old, archaic
law. Sexually transmitted disease.
Yeah. No,
I got you.
The Comstock laws were a set of federal acts passed by the United States Congress under the Grant administration, along with related state laws. The, quote, Parent Act was passed on March 3rd, 1873.
Our dad's birthday.
As the act for the, quote, suppression of trade in and circulation of obscene literature and articles of immoral use. It's the United States and sex. I'll never understand it. Like, Nicole's watching Sex Education.
Yeah.
Like, the Europeans don't care. No. Dick, vagina, butthole. Yep. They say and do anything.
That we can all agree. That's a very American thing, to be real uptight.
To be very prudent.
Again, back to the halftime show. It's kind of crazy how women wearing what they normally honestly wear to any of these performances throws this country in an uproar at a halftime show.
But that's like, I mean, that's a whole other issue, is just in general sex openly spoken about. But it's why we have one of like the highest ratings of teenage pregnancy, is because if we don't talk about it, it's not going to happen. Yeah. Right. Like, I don't ever understand it. I'll never forget my freshman year of high school. We had to take sex ed and we're sitting there, and my mom's a nurse, so I knew all this.
Yeah.
This girl is like, well, I can't get chlamydia because I only give blowjobs. And I'm like, oh,
these are facts,
I'm
actually.
Sorry.
That's a fact, Nicole.
I was like, I'm sorry. What did you say? She's like, well, it's not sex. And I'm like, sure is. Sure is.
Wait, you can get chlamydia from that?
You can get a lot.
Hold on, Nicole. I'm going to write some of this info down that we're about to go over.
But it's like, she never was informed of this. No one talked about it. And I'm sure a lot of parents just assume, my kid's only 14. They're not sexually active. And it's like, it's better to be safe than sorry, friend.
I coach children. I would, nowadays, you teach them young. Teach them young. Be open with it. Like I said, jokes aside, Everyone at this table came from parents that were very open about it, hence why none of us had babies at a young age or any sort of sexually transmitted disease. So
that we know of.
That we know of. Probably putting my business out there like, Mike, chill.
So a lot of you may know this name from pizza or from Snoopy.
Go on.
So Manfred von Richthofen,
the Red Baron,
who was later to be known as the Red Baron, started off in the cavalry as a lancer. But then his unit was disbanded, and he was transferred to the Signal Corps. For over a year, he spent his days stringing telegraph wires along the Western Front. He even won an Iron Cross, third class, for this. In early 1915, he applied for the Imperial Air Service and became an ace with 80 kills when he was finally shot down in April of 1918. The British and Austrians buried him with full military honors. One of the real legends that came out of World War One, like pop culture-wise, is the Red Baron.
He's got a pizza.
And Snoopy inspired.
It's a terrible pizza, but he's got a pizza.
I like the pizza.
Really? Yeah. I do not like Red
Baron
pizza.
But I like thin crust pizza.
Yeah,
so this one, this fact really kind of made it interesting for me because it shows the difference of war over time, but also the bro science that we use of like, why don't they do this and why don't they do that? The stereotype saying about the British World War One soldiers is lions led by donkeys. That's the phrase that they used to say. Okay. The brave soldiers, lions, led by incompetent generals, donkeys, who lived miles behind the front in luxury and out of touch with reality compared to the front lines like the soldiers. But the fact was that the generals were not allowed to go over the top as they were too valuable to lose.
Makes sense. I mean, that is kind of the art of war, right? Where
and even take
someone's got to be in charge. Someone's got to make the calls.
And even nowadays, when people know more secrets, people know more information, like it starts to make sense why you can't have your leadership being in the front lines. As much as we want to have William Wallace, Mel Gibson version out there, that doesn't exist.
That's not strategy, because you got to think, like, that's why people say, I'd rather be, there are a lot of men out there that are better soldiers than they are leaders, and there's a lot of people that weren't great soldiers turn out to be great leaders, because they're very different jobs, so I understand where that comes from, of they do need to be kind of far away, because the decisions they need to be making, we need them around.
With even all these rumors, though, more than 200 generals were killed, wounded, or captured. Most generals visited the front lines every day. In battle, they were considerably closer to the action than their counterparts are today, which mostly are behind drones thousands of miles away.
Yeah.
Now, this one, really fascinating to me.
Like, well, think about that. Our highest military man is in the White House. Like, he's literally across the sea compared to where these wars are going on.
So, one thing in World War One that you see, and in World War II, is how strong the women are and how important women not only are but have always been in modern day wars.
Women are funny. Get over it, Mike.
During World War One, more than 3,000 nurses served in the Canadian Army Medical Corps, 2,504 of which were overseas. They were nicknamed the Bluebirds because they wore blue uniforms with white veils. While they did not work directly on the front lines, they would meet the trucks of wounded soldiers and assist with surgery and post-operative care. Of those who served, 53 died from disease or enemy fire. On June 27, 1918, a German U-boat sank the Canadian hospital ship, the Landovery Castle, killing over 14 nurses aboard. Often referred to as Angels of Mercy or Sisters of Mercy, they are memorialized in the Canadian Parliament Hall of Honor. H.G. Wells was the first person to use the term the war to end all wars to describe World War One. With casualties of up to 15 million people and the absolute destruction it caused, Wells, along with many others, hope that it would teach the world that war was not a solution for settling political conflict. In the end, this hope proved idealistic, and less than three decades later, the world entered another global Clown Flick. We heard a little bit of some stories, or legends.
Revenge of World War One.
We've heard some legends of World War One, but here are some stories that I thought kind of are a good way to wrap up as we head into the finale of World War One. One legendary story about pigeons from the war is that a pigeon named Cher Ami, as the story goes, in October of 1918, American soldiers found themselves trapped by the Germans and cut off from other Allied forces with no working radios. Their only chance of being rescued was sent out by a message through pigeon, alerting the Allies to their location. The pigeon reportedly flew 25 miles from behind German lines to the American headquarters in just 25 minutes. German forces apparently shot the pigeon in the chest, but it continued to fly home and successfully delivered the Lost Battalion's coordinates to the Americans.
There is no way we can prove this story.
A rescue was launched, and 194 men were saved. Cher Ami was awarded the Croix de Guerre with Palm for its incredible feat. Here's another one.
That's Pinky in the Brain. I don't believe that at all.
Even though there never was an official truce. This is one of my favorite stories in world history. Yeah. This story. Even though there never was an official truce during the First World War, they still happen. The most famous one is the 1914 Christmas Truce, when the British and German soldiers got out of the trenches and talked to each other in no man's land. There are also reports of smaller truces in 1915 and even 1916 in the middle of this war. In some trenches, the soldiers adopted a live and let live strategy, trying not to fire on the enemy so that they would not fire on them. As part of British Remembrance Day ceremonies in 1920, David Relton, a chaplain who served on the Western Front, proposed that the body of an unknown soldier, sailor, or airman buried in an unmarked grave be returned to England to be buried in Westminster Abbey. The unknown soldier would become a symbol of all who had died in the war and whose death or burial site was unidentified. On November 11, 1920, the body was taken in procession to the abbey and buried. The site is now one of the most visited war tombs in the world. The lasting effect of World War One is unmeasurable. World War One brought about massive social upheaval as millions of women entered the workforce to support men who went to war and to replace those who never came back. The first global war also helped spread one of the world's deadliest global pandemics, the Spanish flu epidemic of 1918, which killed an estimated 20 to 50 million people. World War One has also been referred to as the first modern war. Many of the technologies we now associate with military conflict, machine guns, tanks, aerial combat, and radio communications, were introduced on a massive scale during World War One. The severe effects that chemical weapons such as mustard gas and phosgene had on soldiers and civilians during World War One galvanized public and military attitudes against their continued use. The Geneva Convention agreements signed in 1925 restricted the use of chemical and biological agents in warfare and remains in effect today. And like we stated earlier, but I think it really needs to be driven home, the two nations most affected were Germany and France, each of which sent some 80% of their population between the ages of 15 and 49 into battle. And that is just a small look in what is becoming almost a forgotten war, in the first modern day war, in what was the Great War that became World War One. What'd you think, good brother?
It's fascinating to see, like, I think the way you said is history repeats itself, and I feel like modern society has more in common with World War One than we do World War Two right now, which is kind of crazy and scary.
Lovely Nicole Mancha?
I think it's really interesting because it's not a war I necessarily knew that much about, in general. I think a lot of us know a lot more about World War II because of our involvement, and also, like, for me personally, because I had family that lived there during that time that I know that I currently, you know, like, my grandmother was in a concentration camp, so it's weird to think, you know what I mean? Like, just one generation before that was so significantly affected, but because that one generation, I don't know, there is, like, a complete disconnect, even though Germany was highly involved.
And this pigeon must have been a John Wick pigeon or something to get shot and keep going. Like, that's ridiculous.
So to me, more importantly, I wanted to just talk about this. This wasn't the most descriptive about the war. This wasn't the most descriptive about the impact of the war. To me, this was more along the lines of talking about something that we just don't see in modern pop culture, in just the way we talk about things. We don't see documentaries about World War One anymore.
In 2020, got a feature length film about it.
1917 compared to the 17 that we get of World War II. Thank you, good brother, for that interjecting. So my point of this is, it's a losing effort to a war that, and honestly, in our dark age of what we love, grittiness and the morbid, is the scariest, dirtiest, most heinous carnage war we've ever seen in that time of history.
We just don't talk
about it. Talk about it.
No, yeah. There's no Band of Brothers. There's no,
no
17 Oscar movie starring Liam Neeson.
But there might be an Oscar coming 1970s way, because if you're listening to this, you already know the answer. And if you would like to see if Good Brother Alex won this year, or if it was Good Brother Michael, you could check out every episode of The Good Brothers. But guys, it's been a long episode. Nicole Manchin desperately needs to go to sleep. You can follow her on Twitter and on Instagram at @TypeOneTipsy. The Good Brother himself is always doing something bad on social media. Mercado21Alex on Twitter and Mercado2121 on Instagram.
Don't follow.
I'm on Twitter at @MikeMedia, on Instagram at @MikeMercadoMedia. You can like us on Facebook at Mercado Airwaves. We have a pop culture show that's on Twitter at Good Brothers Pod.
Best pop culture show in the Midwest.
This show has an Instagram at Murder Mysteries and More. You can follow us everywhere in the universe on Twitter at Mercado Airwaves. So support us on a different level. We're at patreon.com/Mercado Airwaves. And please do us a huge favor. Like, rate, review, and share us, and leave a comment wherever you get your favorite podcast at Mercado Airwaves. For the good brother himself, Alex Mercado.
In the great words of Brad Pitt, arrivederci.
We're loving Nicole Mancha.
Good night, everybody.
That was World War II. I'm Mike Mercado. We'll see you on the next episode of Murder
Mysteries
and More.
Hey guys, Mike here from Mercado Airwaves. We want to thank you so much for all the support you've given us here on the network. And if you want to see what we're up to outside of the station, please follow us all over social media. I'm on Twitter at @MikeMMedia and on Instagram at @MikeMercadoMedia. You can follow the good brother Alex Mercado on Twitter at @Mercado21Alex and on Instagram at @Mercado2121. The lovely Nicole Mancha is on all social media platforms at @TypingWhenTipsy. You can follow the network on Twitter at Mercado Airwaves. Our pop culture show, The Good Brothers, on Twitter at Good Brothers Pod. Our true crime shows on Instagram at Murder Mysteries and More. And of course, like us on Facebook at Mercado Airwaves. You can see all our videos on YouTube.com/MikeMercado2333 or by searching Mercado Airwaves Network. We play video games on Twitch, twitch.tv/Mercado Airwaves Network. And of course, you could support our network by finding a tier just for you, whether you want early access, you want to be part of polls, you want to win contests, prizes by visiting us at patreon.com/Mercado Airwaves. And we really appreciate it wherever you get your favorite podcast to like, rate, review, and share us. And please spread the word. For the good brother Alex Mercado, for the lovely Nicole Mancha, I'm Mike Mercado. We wish you a happy, healthy holiday season and an awesome new year.